I invite you to turn to John chapter 1 and John chapter 10. Our study this evening is not an exposition of these passages, but they form background to the historical circumstances in which Athanasius lived. First of all, John chapter 1, verses 1 to 5, and then verse 14. In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. He was in the beginning with God. All things were made through Him, and without Him was not anything made that was made. In Him was life, and the life was the light of men. The light shines in the darkness, and the darkness has not overcome it. Then verse 14. And the Word became flesh and dwelt among us, and we have seen His glory, glory as of the only Son from the Father, full of grace and truth. And then flipping over to chapter 10 and verse 30. In the Pew Bible, it's found on page 1141. This is Jesus speaking simply to the Jews that are gathered around Him. And He said, I and the Father are one. I want to read a portion of an introduction to a book. Now, some of you may have heard or may be familiar with this introduction. It's by C.S. Lewis. And the setting here in the portion I'm reading is he's commending the reading of old books. Okay? He says, every age has its own outlook. It is especially good at seeing certain truths and especially liable to make certain mistakes. We all, therefore, need the books that will correct the characteristic mistakes of our own period. That means old books. All contemporary writers share, to some extent, the contemporary outlook, even those like myself who seem most opposed to it. So forth. He goes on. Then he says this. You know, what's the remedy to this? He says the only palliative is to keep the clean sea breeze of the centuries blowing through our minds. And this can be done only by reading old books. No, of course, there is any magic about the past. People were no cleverer then than they are now. They made as many mistakes as we, but not the same mistakes. And then one more where he's arguing against simply reading shallow devotional books all the time. And he's saying you need to plow through solid books on theology. So that's the context. So he says, for my own part, I tend to find the doctrinal books more often helpful in devotion than the devotional books. And I rather suspect that the same experience may await many others. I believe that many who find that nothing happens when they sit down or kneel down to a book of devotion would find that the heart sings unbidden while they are working their way through a tough bit of theology. And then he adds, with a pipe in their teeth and a pencil in their hand. But the heart would sing unbidden. So we are here with Athanasius. And oh, by the way, C.S. Lewis' introduction was to a book by Athanasius from the 3rd century A.D. And it was his introduction to the work on the Incarnation. Imagine that. And many of us are acquainted with his introduction. We just didn't know the book or perhaps haven't read it. Athanasius was the bishop of Alexandria, Egypt, And his dates are from about 295 to 373 A.D. There's an outline in the bulletin. I've tried. This is more of an historical study, and I just tried to get it in an outline where we wouldn't get lost. So there are three E's, okay? An edict, an ecclesiastical council, and then enforced exiles, okay? First of all, then, the Edict of Milan, which was signed in 313 A.D. This provides the background for the life of Athanasius. 2 points under this first heading. First of all, the Great Persecution. There were 10 major persecutions of Christians in the Roman Empire. In general, they fall into two categories. The first group were largely local, and they seem to have begun about the time of Nero in the late 60s and around 70s, early 70s, and were localized more around Rome. And there were several others sporadic up to about the year 250. They were all local. But after that, the second phase, empire-wide, Roman legions put to the service to destroy churches and temples, to arrest and kill church leaders, track down, hunt down anyone that named the name of Christ. And that season of empire-wide persecution of Christians is called the Great Persecution. It was the last major persecution of Christians, and it began with a legal document signed by Diocletian, Emperor Diocletian, and it outlawed Christianity completely. You may not even have a copy of the Bible. You certainly may not be called kneeling and praying or meeting on Sunday morning. You'd better not, because they could do with you as they willed. Thousands, thousands of Christians were put to death by various means, often as a spectacle for others to watch how you're killed by wild beasts and so forth. So, background here, under the Edict of Milan that legalized Christianity in 313, we need to be aware of that great persecution from about the year 303 to 312. Second subpoint here, under the Edict of Milan, when did this great persecution end? It was the Battle of the Milvian Bridge in October of 312. This is one of the most important, one of the greatest decisive battles in military history. Great Constantine, or Constantine the Great, defeated the enemy just outside the streets of Rome. Constantine had a Christian wife. And shortly after that victory, and he took control of the empire, he signed an edict in Milan legalizing Christianity. All right? Athanasius was a teenager during these years. He grew up with this kind of political and cultural atmosphere in Alexandria, and anywhere he traveled. So, first point, Edict of Milan ceased the persecution, made Christianity legal. 2 points under that, the Great Persecution from Diocletian, and then the Battle of the Milvian Bridge that ended the hostilities. We thought, they thought. Second point, Ecclesiastical Council, that of Nicaea in 325. Again, subpoints, trying to help this, give it to you so it's easy to follow. Conflicts, council, creed, three C's. The conflicts that brought about the Council of Nicaea, they actually all began in Alexandria, Egypt, where Athanasius was. At that time, he was a helper to the bishop of Alexandria by the name of Alexander. And they started during Alexander's reign as bishop, and there were two of them. Number one, there was a reaction to the lenient treatment given to those who denied the faith during the great persecution. Okay? If you denied Christ, whatever form, often it was simply signing a document that you were not a Christian and you would worship Roman gods, or you would turn over copies of the Bible and you'd get off scot-free. Can you imagine what it was like to go to church with people now once the hostilities were over? You used to have a pew full of your family members. Now it's only half full because the others were caught, tortured, put to death by the Romans because they would not deny Christ. Right behind you is a pew that's full of people who went through the same persecution, and they just signed a little document. Yeah, I deny Jesus. And now the trouble's over, and you're back in church together worshiping God. There was a huge reaction to the lenient treatment of those who denied Christ during the great persecution. So that was the first issue. Second issue, second conflict, was, and this one was even greater than the first one, and it engulfed the entire empire. It engulfed the entire church. And it was this, the teaching of a deacon in Alexandria by the name of Arius. He was not a deacon, he was an elder. And he advocated the view that Jesus was not eternal, but was created by the Father. Okay, that was the second issue, the teaching of Arius, and it spread like wildfire. You know who are Arians in our day? They deny the orthodox teaching of who Jesus is. Jehovah's Witnesses. Jehovah's Witnesses are Arians, heretics. Okay, those are the two issues in the conflicts. Lenient treatment, the teaching of Arius. Now, conflicts council. Council of Nicaea, a village in northern Asia Minor that's now part of the city of Iznik in Turkey. And they started on the 4th of July, hot summer day. There were no fireworks, at least they hadn't made their way to Asia Minor at that point. But as such, the opening ceremonies consisted of Emperor Constantine having proclaimed himself a bishop in the church and an apostle, and he stood there and called the council to order. Now, that would bring other problems, this confusion of church and state, you can well imagine. But Constantine called them to order on the 4th of July in Nicaea in 325. There were 300 bishops. It included Alexander from Alexandria, Egypt, and Athanasius went with him as his aide to this church council. There were 2,000 elders and deacons at this council as well. Well, there's conflicts, council, now the creed. I just want to draw your attention to some of the wording in the Nicene Creed that we have just inside the front cover of our hymnals. Four key assertions about the person of Jesus that were hammered out at the Council of Nicaea. All right? And Athanasius was there, and he would give his life for these simple statements, what we might think is simple statements. The story was just beginning for him. Key assertions. Let's see. Look at the second line. Very God of very God. Speaking of Jesus Christ. That's assertion number one. Very God of very God. That is, Jesus himself was God in the same sense that the Father is God. Okay? That's what it's saying. Very God of very God. Second key assertion follows, that he was begotten, not made. Begotten, not made. That is, Jesus was never formed as all other things and persons had been created, but was from eternity the Son of God. Theological language, he is eternally begotten. See, Arius argued there was a time when Jesus was not. No, it's not what the Bible teaches at all. He was begotten, not made. All right? Third assertion, of one being of one substance with the Father. This is seemed like a reinforcing statement that unequivocally as possible, the fact is stressed that Jesus was truly very God of very God. It seems they're being redundant. They're wanting to be emphatic, emphasize this point. Fourth assertion here in the creed was that Jesus became human for us and for our salvation. That's on line 4 in the creed. Who for us and for our salvation came down from heaven. This phrase clearly summarizes the burden of the concern of Athanasius. That Christ could not have brought salvation to his people if Christ were only a creature. He couldn't. Mere humanity could not pull itself up to God. Could not. Only God could do it. Salvation is of God, worked out in detail in the life of the God-man, the eternally begotten Son of God, same substance of the Father, very God of very God, begotten, not made. And he came for us and for our salvation. One thing that bothers me at times when we even use the language of John about Jesus came to save the world, you know, and we misunderstand that. It seems to lose the personal element that Jesus came for me, that Jesus came for you. I would like for you to hear that afresh tonight. That Jesus became the eternal Son of God, became a real human being for you and for your salvation. The creed says he came for us and for our salvation. Okay, that's the council. Now, you would think, okay, we've seen the Edict of Milan declared Christianity legal. The Ecclesiastical Council of Nicaea, just a few years later in 325, you would think that would settle things, wouldn't you? Ah, now, let's get on with living. Oh, no. See, Arius was very well connected politically with the emperors of Rome. And he lost. And he didn't like it. So he began to talk with the emperors and spread lies. And there was a man, his arch nemesis was a man who would, in a couple of years, become the bishop of Alexandria, Egypt. His nickname was the Black Dwarf. He was an African, apparently not of great stature. The Black Dwarf, Athanasius. But Athanasius ended up being the champion of Nicaea. And it cost him severely. That brings us to our third point, enforced exiles. Because the opposition, the steadfast opposition that Athanasius had to Arius, and the devotion and loyalty Athanasius had to the Nicene Creed and the statements about the Lord Jesus Christ, he became the target of political persecution. There was a price on his head. There was a bounty, dead or alive. And he was hunted for over 17 years of his 45-year pastorate in Alexandria. Now, I'd like to give you just a quick survey and a couple of stories of those exiles. There were five of them. You know, we say the Nicene Creed and we think, hope the music is better, you know. And we have no idea what it has cost our brothers and sisters for those very words we repeated so easily. As I said, there were five political exiles where Athanasius was running for his life. The first one was about 3 years, 335 to 337. And at the end of it, guess who died? Arius. Arius, the heretic, died. The one that had political connections and set the emperor and his legions on Athanasius. He dies. And it was in a well-known manner in the early church. There was a victory celebration for him. Arius, you know, I have political clout. And they're chasing that outlaw Athanasius and who knows where. And there was a parade and a banquet in honor of Arius. And so he's marching in the parade and crowds are gathered and they're cheering him. Yes, yes, yes. All of a sudden, he gets severely ill. Runs into a nearby public latrine and doesn't come out. And finally, people have to go in and find him. He's dead. He's face down in a toilet. That dishonorable death spread in the early church. They commonly understood it as God's judgment against him for his heresy about God the Son. So Arius dies during the first exile of Athanasius, but the exiles continued. The second one was the longest one, almost 10 years, where he was kept away from his flock there in Alexandria. The third one was about 356 to 362, a couple of stories about that. They removed, you know, Athanasius had to flee, and a man named George was put in his place. And George was not a very good leader in the church. And actually, he had sold pork in Constantinople before he was given this political appointment. And he was a fraudulent bishop. However, he made a good bit of wealth while in that position of authority. And he was a zealous Arian. And he was going to enforce it in Alexandria, you know, kind of ground zero for the whole problem anyway. Well, people got tired of that, got tired of his zeal and his lifestyle. And it wasn't long. I think he was just there in that position of authority for about 4 years. And on one occasion in November the 30th, after the death of the son of Constantine, then they were looking for George, tired of this, and they were coming to get him. They found him, all right, and the stories vary just a little bit. One says they tied him to a camel, and they killed both George and the camel, then burned them. This older account says that they dragged him from his home and lynched him in the streets. This is during the third exile. Athanasius was not there, but people were tired of the Arians. Another story, when the Roman legions were sent to search for Athanasius, this is commonly what happened. Let me read you the account of Thursday night, June 13th in 356. In the early hours of Thursday, after a service had begun, just as all the congregation except a few women had gone on, the Roman legions appeared. All those that were still in the church were murdered. The church was wrecked, polluted with the, this is an old version, that was polluted with the very worst orgies of heathenism. Houses and even tombs were ransacked throughout the city and the suburbs of Alexandria on the pretense of, we're looking for Athanasius. That's how the Roman legions did their looking. If you were part of his church, if you held to the Nicene Creed, if you opposed Arius, that might happen to you. And it did. Athanasius was not there. He found safety. Athanasius found safety during his exiles among the desert monks. There's a lot. I wish we had PowerPoint or something. I could show you a map and the monastic centers up and down the Nile. And there, look, you're a long way from a Dollar General store out there, buddy. And it's just these monks are near the river for a source of water, but there's no one for hundreds of miles. But to the man, I love that language in the account. To the man, all of those desert monks held to the Nicene Creed. Every one of them. They were Athanasians. And they provided shelter, often under their own threat of death and torture. But he found safety among the desert monks. During this third exile, he wrote the life of one of the leading monks, Antony. It became a New York Times bestseller. You know, and there were advertisements for giveaways on TV for this Life of Antony. It's still available. And actually, I found out after Rob preached on Augustine last week that a copy of the Life of Antony by Athanasius was handed to Augustine as a young man and was one of the components in his conversion, because he saw this livingness of Christianity in the life of Antony. All right, need to move along. The fourth exile, just one quick story, about 362 to 364. Athanasius had sneaked into Alexandria to try to help with some problems, and then he gets on a boat in the Nile, and he's headed out of town, only to realize he's being followed. He's being pursued by those that want the bounty on his head. Well, it's in the dark, and Athanasius has an idea. He tells the guys with him, turn the boat around and head toward them in the dark. So they don't like that idea, but he's pretty firm and says, head toward the men that are pursuing us. Well, sure enough, they get close, and the pursuers holler to the other boat, hey! Have you seen Athanasius? And the reply from Athanasius comes, he's very close. He's not far off. If you hurry, you'll be able to overtake him. And they just pass like ships in the night. Okay. All right. The fifth one, y'all, these are all over the same issue. Who is Jesus Christ? Do you believe, according to the Nicene Creed, that he is the Son of God, eternally begotten, very God, a very God? That was the issue for Athanasius. All right, well, quickly, you know, to conclude, what are some benefits for studies like this? They have their place, right? Christian biographies. Well, I've got a couple of things. Number one, we benefit by being able to distinguish orthodoxy from heresy. From sound doctrine sound doctrine from false belief. That's one benefit. Second one, we benefit by being introduced to stellar examples of faith, love, courage, hope, obedience, and mercy, including the costly commitment to the truth by Athanasius. Another benefit, we benefit by being encouraged to focus on the essentials of Christianity. That is, to major on those areas that have been repeatedly emphasized throughout the history of the church. What are the big, strong doctrines the church has always held? This is one of them. Another benefit is we benefit by connection to the church in the past. What has the church believed before us? We get a sense of rootedness, of depth, of certainty, of hope by studying the lives of those who have gone before us and whom we'll meet in that last great day.